From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Bloody summit in Genoa. Police shoot and kill an activist, then run him over with an armored vehicle. More than 450 are injured, hundreds arrested. We'll talk to activists in Italy. We'll look at how academics and corporations collaborate with the military to develop deadly weapons for crowd control. And the Indonesian president is impeached. His successor is closely linked to the army. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. On Friday, Italian police at the G8 summit in Genoa, Italy, shot and killed a 23-year-old Italian activist named Carlo Giuliani. The man was shot and then run over by a police vehicle as it left the scene. More than 450 people were injured and hundreds arrested in protests held during the meeting of the leaders of the world's richest nations and Russia. An overnight raid by Italian police on the headquarters of the anti-globalization movement Genoa Social Forum left dozens of activists wounded before the Group of Eight summit ended. The raid on the last day of the summit of world leaders began shortly after midnight and went on for 2 hours. President George W. Bush and Russian President Vladimir Putin have agreed to hold talks about linking U.S. plans for building a so-called missile defense shield to reducing both nations' nuclear stockpiles. The breakthrough was announced following a meeting between the two leaders at the G8 summit in Genoa. Putin had previously flatly refused to discuss the U.S. anti-missile shield plans. Putin had also previously warned that if the U.S. breached the ABM treaty, Russia would tear up all other arms control agreements. Indonesia's National Assembly impeached President Abdurrahman Wahid today and elected his deputy, Megawati Sukarnoputri, as head of state. The motion to dismiss Wahid was passed by 591-0. The vote was taken after army generals and senior police officers rejected an emergency decree issued hours before by Wahid that had ordered the assembly's immediate suspension. Wahid became Indonesia's first democratic head of state in 44 years when the same assembly elected him in October 1999. On Sunday, he declared a state of emergency and ordered Indonesia's military to dissolve the assembly. The military refused, instead deployed troops and tanks to protect legislators in the capital. The Supreme Court has ruled that Wahid has no power to block impeachment. We'll be speaking with Ben Anderson, Cornell University professor and one of the world's leading scholars on Indonesia, in just a few minutes. Both houses of Congress on Friday approved $6.5 billion in additional government spending this year, most of it for the Pentagon, in a bill that closely resembles Bush's original request for a supplemental spending. Despite pressure from fellow Democrats to raise spending on many Democratic programs, the new chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee, Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia, cooperated with the White House in holding the spending bill to $6.5 billion. Under the bill, the Pentagon will receive $5.6 billion of the new spending this year for fuel, health care, and housing, among other expenses. About $44 million is to go to repair the USS Cole, the destroyer badly damaged by the attack in Yemen in October, and $36 million is to go to efforts to recover bodies from a Japanese fishing boat sunk off Hawaii in February in a collision with an American submarine. The bill also provided $116 million to enable the Treasury Department to mail the tax rebate checks Congress authorized when it approved a tax cut package this spring. Connecticut Senator Joseph Lieberman will meet with President Bush this week in hopes of building support in the Senate for legislation giving religious institutions more federal money for their charitable works. the support of Lieberman, who has built his career as a conservative Democrat with a strong interest in helping religious groups, could be pivotal as the president seeks to gain Senate passage. House Democrats who voted on partisan lines against the measure said they believe the administration's true purpose was to overturn civil rights and that Republicans would never delete the provisions allowing religions to discriminate in hiring, even with federal money. The Assembly of First Nations, Canada's largest Indian organization, is threatening to block highways across the country if the federal government continues to bypass Indian leaders with plans to revamp the Federal Indian Act. Matthew Coon Combe, national chief, gave the government of Canada 30 days to change direction or face acts of civil disobedience that could disrupt the economy. In the past, Indian blockades have led to violent confrontations with the police. The government has been meeting with tribal members to promote changes to the Indian Act that it says will improve Indian governance and accountability. And after putting an energy deregulation plan on hold when the power crisis struck this year, Nevada has taken a step toward easing some regulations for large customers. Governor Kenny Guinn signed a bill that will allow large consumers like casinos and mines to buy electricity from suppliers other than the state's primary utility, Nevada Power.
I just want to ask a question. Who really cares? To save a world in despair. Who really cares? There'll come a time when the world won't be singing. Flowers won't grow. Bells won't be ringing. Who really cares? Who's willing to try? To save a world? Destined to die. When I look at the world, it fills me with sorrow.
Save the Children by the prophetic Marvin Gaye from his classic What's Going On recording, recorded in Detroit, April 5th, 1971. As we move to Genoa, Italy, where, as we said on Friday, Italian police at the G8 summit shot and killed a 23-year-old Italian activist named Carlo Giuliani, then ran over him with an armored vehicle. Last night, an overnight raid by Italian police on the headquarters of the anti-globalization movement Genoa Social Forum left dozens of activists wounded before the Group of Eight summit ended. We turn now to Enzo Lefredres, who is a journalist at the Independent Media Center where the raid took place. He was across the street. Welcome to Democracy Now! Enzo, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Hello, everyone. I'm just here to help you, reminding you what's going on in Myanmar during those days.
Can you tell us what happened as you watched across the street with the raid that left so many people injured?
Yeah, there were more than 20 people injured. I was looking from the other building across the street, from the GSF info point, and I saw so many people bleeding from their heads because the police just charged inside the building, and there were people sleeping, and just the police started beating them with a lot of violence.
Did they explain why they moved into the IMC at the end of the G8 summit?
Well, they didn't have an allowance by the police chief of the city, but they did enter inside with excuse for finding people from the black bloc. They did not find people from the Black Bloc inside, and they had the excuse that they found some guns. Some weapons. But in fact, they were like just labor things because they're work in progress in the school, and the workers just left there some things for work.
We're also joined on the telephone from Genoa by Ricardo Magon, who is an American activist. Can you talk about the weekend, Ricardo?
Sorry? Yeah, what?
Ricardo, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Can you lay out where you have been over the weekend and the level of violence right now against the protesters?
Well, right now it's all kind of calmed down, but obviously the most severe violence was the man being killed, and the whole place was locked down with violence because they had surrounded the center of the city with a barricade and police armed with tear gas and rubber bullets to prevent anyone from getting close to the summit.
Can you explain what you understand of what happened with the young man, the 23-year-old, who was killed by the police, Carlo Giuliani?
Well, I mean, I should first tell you I wasn't near there at all. I was in another demonstration, another part. There were several demonstrations that happened that day and simultaneously around the city. But, I mean, they've showed the news footage repeatedly, and obviously, I think the pictures speak much better than the words. He was behind a police van, and you can clearly see the policeman with a gun in his hand and fires on him, and she falls down and then is run over backwards by the truck, runs him over. And the police have changed their story. First they said it was that they couldn't see because of the tear gas. But it's clear in the footage that there is no tear gas. They were perfectly capable of seeing what they were doing.
And was their explanation afterwards not only for the shooting, but for running him over with an armored vehicle?
Not that I know. Was their explanation for why they ran him over?
They said they had to back the van up.
They're claiming self-defense for the shooting, of course, because people were pelting the car with rocks.
Has there been an explanation of why police were using live ammunition?
Not that I know. There has not been an explanation of why they're using live ammunition. Mm-hmm. It's a big controversy here. This is not like the United States. People are taking this very seriously.
Let me go back to Enzo Lefredris. The number of people injured in last night's raids, one more time, of the Independent Media Center. Enzo.
Yeah, the problem is that the Independent Media Center had two buildings. The one across the street was full of people that were sleeping at that time. There were a lot of independent media journalists, and the number of people that were injured inside that building where they were asleep is more than 20 people. And all the other people were arrested immediately, so we've got no testimony in Seattle, apart from 10 people that could escape from the windows.
There's an Italian parliamentary inquiry which is beginning today into the violence. It's interesting to watch the Sunday talk shows in the United States. You wouldn't have a sense that almost anything happened in Genoa. The discussion simply referred to mainly if there was any mention, the violence of the protesters. What about that? Who were the people? I mean, there's a kind of lumping together of protesters. If we're talking about 100,000 people and hundreds of non-governmental organizations around the world, can you talk about, each of you, who came to Genoa?
Well, the Genoa Social Forum had more than 800 NGOs applying to the meeting. The fact is that there were a lot of pacifists. The people were more than 150,000 in Genoa, the 21st. The problem is that yesterday was the Genoa Social Forum in the last press conference showed to all the people and to the old journalists that we've got proofs of policemen trying to vest with black blocks trousers and clothes. So we've got the proofs that police was trying and was planning to suffocate all the demos in January, not only the demos of the white overalls or the disobedience people, but of course all others, NGOs and especially the pacifists and the pink bloc.
I want to ask, Ricardo, are you standing next to Mick McCann?
Yeah, I am. I'm very near Mick McCann.
Could you also put him on the line?
Absolutely. Hang on a second. You want to go right now? Hang on. Mick.
We're talking to two activists, one journalist who was across the street from the Independent Media Center last night, Enzo Lefredres, when the police moved in on the IMC, the other Ricardo Magon, an American activist in Genoa. Mick McCann is a reporter for the Irish Times, who has been following events throughout the weekend. And again, the Italian parliamentary inquiry begins today into the violence. The G8 say they'll be meeting next in Canada, high up in the mountains, to get away from the protests. Before we go to Mick McCann, Enzo Lefredres, I wanted to ask you about the new prime minister of Italy, Berlusconi, if you think that someone who owns all of the media, the major media in Italy, what would you tie his ascendancy and his leadership in Italy to the approach of the police and the military in Genoa this week?
Well, of course, the fact that Berlusconi right now is the prime minister helped a lot the police in having this behavior to the demos, and of course there are a lot of injustice going on by police that are justified by Berlusconi itself. So yeah. I would say that in part it's fault or of Berlusconi to be now prime minister for those violence told by the police in Genoa.
Mick McCann, are you there?
I am indeed. Yep, good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Mick McCann is a reporter for the Irish Times. Can you talk about, from your perspective, observing the activities this week, the events in Italy, what you think most stands out? There is very little coverage in the United States about what happened in Genoa, except discussion of violent protesters.
Well, the purpose of my visit to Genoa is really to act as a sort of a grassroots observer, chronicling exactly what happened from the beginning of the arrival of thousands of people into Genoa, the reactions of Genoa people, and the build-up, the parallel build-up of by police and the hype surrounding the police operation. So from that point of view, arriving on Monday, Tuesday, to the Carlini Sports Stadium, which was provided by the authorities in order to sort of know where people were and in a sense provide facilities so that people weren't wandering the streets with no purpose and no facilities. So settling out there the first night, at 6:30 in the morning, we were awoken by a loud hailer telling us that there was a police raid about to begin, that 500 cops were outside in full gear with riot shields coming in. Now, you're talking about thousands of people who had arrived the previous night up to 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. They were very tired, very disoriented after a day's travel from different countries, Greece, Spain, and so on. And suddenly they're being told to gather everything and get to the door to line up for this police raid, which could have been violent. So that, for a start, put everybody in a sort of a war footing. It made people tense, it made people fearful, and that whole situation leads to a volatility, which I think exaggerated events on the streets following that. At the same time, the Genoese people, and we were being told about body bags being flown in, about temporary morgues, about all annual leave being cancelled for doctors and nurses. So that in a sense, the police were saying, this is a war, we're preparing for deaths. And in a sense, Blair and Bush's comments during the week when Tony Blair called for a more robust approach to these protesters, that in a sense is a green light for violence by the police. At the same time, you had this really a celebration of sharing and caring that I saw in the stadium, where thousands of people from all over the world, some of them would have met down in Chiapas at peace camps, which were like little laboratories for sort of exploring ideas for change. So you had people who spent time down there who now came to the sort of closest point, if you like, the closest front line to the people who make the crucial decisions affecting people in the third world, affecting debt, affecting investigation to AIDS, finance, the arms trade, etc., etc. So you had these two sides, in a sense, one of which has 150,000 people mobilized on the streets. The other has absolutely nobody mobilized to support their position on the streets, other than 20,000 very heavily armed and very nervous and very inexperienced police. And I think it's very significant that the police officer who appears to have fired the fatal shot at the 23-year-old protester, A, he was 20 years old, and B, he had never been in a tense situation before. He was inexperienced.
What kind of coverage do you see coming from Genoa? Because in the United States, as I was just saying before you got on the line, there's almost no coverage except to paint the protesters with one brushstroke, which is violent. And how did NPR put it on one of the talk shows? I think they just said they're all against world capitalism, something like that. And they were all hailing Bono of U2, who had said he would not be in Genoa. He would not join the protesters because he was for debt reduction, not for violence.
Well, I think this is exactly the problem. As an Irish person, I'm well aware of Bono's history in terms of being attached to various movements, whether it's Amnesty International, playing benefits for Greenpeace and so on, all very worthwhile. But there's definitely a sense in which Bono is completely out of touch with the reality of daily life for people facing what we call the first violence, which is the violence of structural adjustment and state terror in Latin America. And just to diverge for a second, 3 weeks ago in the north of Argentina, two passersby were shot dead by police right beside a protest that was taking place. That got absolutely no coverage, of course. And that was a protest at structural adjustment and the reduction of people's wages for public employees in the north of Argentina. So you have this first violence, which is exercised with absolute impunity throughout one section of the world, while people like Bono have the luxury, and I mean, I respect Bono for actually, as somebody who is a rock star and could very easily turn his back completely on all this, for taking the time out to try and seek alleviation of world debt. But that is really only a symptom of something much deeper and much more profound in terms of trying to resolve issues of poverty, safe drinking water, health, education, the building blocks of a healthy, sane people, if you like, who have a chance to get beyond 40 years of age in terms of life expectancy. Now, the coverage, I think, varies from country to country. Ireland and Britain would be reasonable in terms. You've got newspapers like The Guardian, The Independent, and even The Irish Times, which very much defends the economic model, is also vigorously defends the right to protest. And our own foreign minister in Ireland, when he was called upon to sort of challenge some of the Irish people who were traveling to Genoa, said there was no way he would interfere with the right to travel. Whereas in Italy, you had borders closed, you had 1,000 people turned away. So there's that whole contradiction between freedom of movement and actually implementing it when it came to a protest here. As a journalist, I mean, in a sense, I work with the mainstream press, with the Irish Times. I also did coverage for Irish radio. At the same time, I was absolutely attached to the Indy Media Centre, which is this was a very important stage this week, was that you saw the mainstream media taking pictures from Indy Media and taking testimony from Indy Media, because that was where people came to. Their sort of slogan, if you like, is don't hate the media, become the media. And in a sense, it's an empowering that people could come up to Indy Media, tell their story, and it immediately went up on the website. And given that most of the mainstream press were at the summit and completely removed from the scene of the events, that was a crucial sort of nerve center for establishing, to the best of available time and energies, what was happening, given that obviously people came in a state of anxiousness and hysteria. after being beaten up. I mean, I saw two journalists come in. One woman had been cornered by seven policemen. She put down her bag, she put up her hands, and they came and they beat her over the head. Her head was streaming blood, and she had had her batteries and her tape removed. Another guy who works with a who worked with a sub-editor for Loaded, which is a fairly despicable a lads magazine in Europe, he had been hit with what he wasn't sure whether it was a tear gas canister or a bullet in the leg, because he felt a pain. He had it bandaged up, but he never smelled the tear gas, so it's hard to say. But in a sense, it was an outrageous abuse of by the police. And as I was on the protest, main protest, as it came down towards the sort of crucial point, and tear gas was fired into the crowd before anything happened. And when tear gas is fired, that immediately makes people go insane. They disperse, and some people at the front, a large number of people, not just Black Bloc, will immediately start throwing stones as a matter of defence. And very, very few people will actually stand close enough to police to directly threaten their lives. And I think the events we saw were a result of inexperience, the aggressive hype and build-up by the police, and a sense of chaos that prevailed in the city at that moment.
Mick McCann, I want to thank you very much for being with us, who was a grassroots observer on the ground reporting for the Irish Times, speaking to us from Genoa. Before that, Enzo Lefredris, who is an independent journalist at the IMC across the street of the Independent Media Center when it was raided last night. Scores of people seriously injured by police. I want to thank you all very much for being with us. When we come back from our break, we'll be joined by Professor Ben Anderson to talk about the events of today in Indonesia. The president of Indonesia has just been impeached. Stay with us.
Blackout dark. No business deal big enough. No heart hollow. No grave wide enough to bury your story, to keep it from us.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we reported in the headlines, Indonesia's National Assembly has just impeached President Abdurrahman Wahid today and elected his deputy, Megawati Soekarno-Putri, as head of state. The motion to dismiss Wahid was 591-0. The vote was taken after army generals and senior police officers rejected an emergency decree issued hours before by Wahid that ordered the assembly's immediate suspension. We're joined on the telephone right now from Ithaca, New York, by Ben Anderson, professor of Southeast Asian Studies at Cornell University, one of the world's leading scholars on Indonesia, was banned from the fourth most populous country, Indonesia, for more than two decades. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's good to have you with us, Professor Anderson. Can you talk about the significance of today's events?
Well, I mean, the fact that the vote is overwhelming tells you something. 590-0 means that the sort of decree to which Wahid unfortunately managed to throw away a lot of support that he had is something very important, because in many ways his positions have been very good. He's been for the federalization of the country so that the minorities and regions can have a better relationship with the center. He's spoken out rehabilitating former members of the Communist Party who had been sort of politically and socially in every other way ostracized for three decades. He's been clear about the need to avoid any conflicts between Christians and Muslims. He has a long record under Suharto of being in favor of democratization and so forth. And he's an intelligent and wily man, but he's somebody clearly who's been shaped by 25 years of work as an opposition person and had very little idea how actually to run a country. So he changed ministers every 15 minutes practically, and doesn't keep his mouth shut when he ought to.
What exactly was he impeached for?
Well, this is actually, still hasn't actually really been impeached. Formally, it was two charges of corruption, which are very flimsy indeed. Most people that I know don't really think that he is corrupt, certainly nothing compared to the Suharto gang or many of the most prominent politicians in Indonesia today. The real animus against him is not that. The real animus is his bruising personal style, the fact that he's interfered in the military in a way that's enraged many generals, the fact that he hasn't done what people hoped, which was to attend to the problems of the ethnic violence in Indonesia. He spent a lot of time on expensive trips overseas, that he was elected as a minority president by a coalition of different groups who expected that he would therefore give them lots of places in the government, which he hasn't done. So the pretext for getting rid of him are not the real reasons why people in the political elite want him out.
Can you talk about the person who will replace him, Megawati Sukarnoputri? She's little known here, but to say the least, an extremely significant and historic figure in Indonesia, given her family.
Well, that's the interesting thing about her. I mean, she is one of the daughters of former President Sukarno, who was a hugely loved political leader from the 1920s when he first entered politics, until he was overthrown in 1965.
The founding president of Indonesia.
Founding president, but more than that, I mean, he really paid his dues in the anti-colonial movement. He was imprisoned, internally exiled for many years. He was a magnetic speaker, a man of enormous charm, and so forth. So Megawati is there, not because she has any particular charm herself, but because she is symbolically as often happens in Asia. You see this in Ceylon, you see it in India, in Pakistan, many places, Philippines. People see many of these prominent women as emanations or of men who have died in one form or another, or who were important figures in the past. That is, if she wasn't his daughter, she wouldn't be anywhere. Her character is completely different. She's very a silent woman. She has very little gift for oratory. She's very conservative in many ways, unlike her father, to the point that some of her younger sisters have gone on the record publicly saying, well, she may be his biological daughter, but she certainly isn't his political daughter.
Most significantly, what about her relationship with the military? And this could have very serious effect on places like Aceh, where more than 1,000 people have been killed since the beginning of the year.
Well, I think this is the most ominous side of, there are two ominous sides to her. One is that she's been brought up with a kind of very conservative Javanese type of nationalism, which says that at all costs the country's basic form cannot be changed. She was bitterly hostile to the independence of East Timor when Shanana Kusmau was invited by Rohan Wahid to come to Jakarta on East Timor. Wahid's always been very good. Megawati, as the vice president, refused to meet him, which shows a very small mind. And she's got surrounded in her party by retired generals, who many of whom have East Timor records, bad East Timor records. So she's very much identified with a kind of tough line from the center. She was received extremely badly in Papua New Guinea last year. Stuff was thrown at her by the angry Papuans, which she hasn't forgotten. She has no sympathy with the Achenese at all, so that's very worrying. The other side to her, which is bad news, is her husband, the man called Taufik Kemas, who everybody knows is a big crook, I mean, a financial crook. And people, of course, are worried that she can't control him and that the party nominally is hers, but actually is more and more his. So that, and there's plenty of bad things on the record about what her party's been doing in the regions.
Her husband came to the United States right about 2 months ago trying to push for the resumption of U.S. military aid to Indonesia.
That's right. That's his position, and he's in the regions in many places. The party, which had a history of being against the military because it was Suharto's tool, now cozying up to some of the most unpleasant military people in the regions. And what they're doing quietly is taking over a lot of the properties of the Suharto family.
What about the relations of Megawati Sukarnoputri, her family, with companies like ExxonMobil, which is operating one of the largest gas fields mm-hmm. in the world in Aceh, and what role that plays in the military crackdown there?
Well, I think it's very important. I don't think it's Megawati herself. I mean, nobody says that she's corrupt personally. She hasn't got a string of kids who are doing anything bad. But the thing is that the army is desperately short of money. Give you an idea of how desperately short of money it is, that during the last phase of East Timor brutalities, it came to light last year that many of these militias in East Timor, including actual Indonesian army people, were being paid with forged currency. And the forged currency was produced at the orders of the head of military intelligence in collusion with the governor of the bank in Indonesia, who sold the head of military intelligence genuine serial numbers from the bank. Now, if the head of military intelligence has to pay the militias in forged currency, obviously they're financially in great trouble. It's a very expensive military, and if Indonesia doesn't have the income coming in from big corporations like Exxon and so forth, then control by the central military over local commanders, which is already not very strong, will decrease. And that's something of great concern to the military high command.
Finally, in U.S. military aid, it stopped at the height of the violence against the Timorese around the time of the referendum
right.
2 years ago. Do you think Megawati's Sukarnoputri's ascension could mean a resumption?
Yes, I think so. I think that's on the cards. There's noises coming out of Washington saying, it's time to go in there again. I mean, there are plenty of people in this administration who think that in the end, and who will hold Indonesia together, is going to be the military. And the argument has always been for years and years and years, decades of American support and training and money for the military is that we need to have influence with these guys. We can prevent them doing bad things. We can upgrade their qualities and so forth. I mean, it seems to me this is a complete illusion. The worst horrors that took place in Aceh and East Timor and Papua New Guinea have been done by the elite troops of the Red Berets and the Army Strategic Command, and these are precisely the units which the United States for years boasted about the quality of their training and the fact that they'd been special human rights education and so forth and so forth. These turned out to be the worst guys. So that's not going to stop people in Washington from thinking that there needs to be some element of strength and stability in the state. And the only thing they can see is like that is, in their view, the military. The politicians are squabbling, they're not giving any leadership and so forth. But my own view is that's an illusion. The army is by no means united, and it's got enormous problems accumulating from the Suharto regime.
Well, Ben Anderson, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We'll certainly continue to follow events there with the impeachment of the current president of Indonesia. We are going to follow what happens with Megawati Sukarnoputri, who ascends to the presidency. Ben Anderson, professor of Southeast Asian Studies at Cornell University, one of the world's leading scholars on Indonesia, author of many books, including Imagined Communities and The Specter of Comparison, speaking to us from Ithaca, New York. When we come back from our break, we're going to look at military-academic collaboration. if Seattle opened the world's eyes to the new movement against corporate-led globalization, Genoa may well have opened the world's eyes to the reality of police brutality against protesters. On Saturday, Italian paramilitary policemen shot a protester twice in the head, then ran over his body with an armored vehicle. That same night, Italian police raided a school where scores of peaceful protesters and independent journalists were staying. They beat people indiscriminately, at least 60 injured. Hours after the raid, there was blood on the walls and floors, broken windows, smashed furniture, and personal belongings strewn all over. These two events were exceptionally horrific, but police brutality against protesters is not new. Police raided activists' headquarters ahead of the Republican National Convention in Philadelphia, and the use of tear gas, pepper spray, and water cannons against protesters is now standard practice. Today, in our last segment, we're going to look at how academics and corporations collaborate with the military to produce weapons, which eventually end up in the hands of soldiers and the police. A few weeks ago, the British magazine New Scientist published an article about how the Pentagon is searching for a new crowd control weapon, a non-lethal stink bomb. Cognitive psychologists and neuroscientists funded by the military have joined forces to find a smell that will terrify people so much that they've no choice but to run from the scene. We come back from our break. We'll talk to a reporter who looked at the stink bomb. And we're going to talk to an academic who is involved with opportunities in biotechnology for future Army applications and look at biotech as weapons. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. We're going to start off this segment with Stephanie Payne, writer for New Scientist magazine. Her piece is about stink bombs. It starts, "Can you imagine the most terrifying smell in the world? Gotta get out of here. Heart's pounding. Can't think. Can't speak. Daren't breathe. Just run. As the stench rolls down the street, panic spreads. Everyone's on the run now. They don't know what the evil-smelling odor is, but their noses tell them it's dangerous. And within seconds, their stomachs sound the general alarm. In 2 minutes, the streets are empty. All that's left is a terrible stink. This hasn't happened yet, but it could if the U.S. Army succeeds in its effort to create the mother of all stink bombs. Their aim is to have a weapon that doesn't kill or injure anyone, but instead triggers fear, panic, and an overwhelming urge to run away. The mixture of malodorous molecules has to add up to a pong so repulsive, it's truly terrifying. The search for the perfect stink bomb is part of the Pentagon's non-lethal weapons program. The U.S. Army wants a stink to drive away enemy troops or hostile crowds and to enforce no-go zones around sensitive military installations. We are joined now by Stephanie Payne. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
Hi, it's good to have you with us. Can you explain how the scientists, people like Pam Dalton, who you wrote about, a cognitive psychologist at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia, are developing this weapon?
Well, let me say, first of all, they're not developing it as a weapon at this particular moment. It's very early stages. What they're trying to do is to identify the world's most repulsive smell, which, if they can find something that would work on just about everyone who had a sense of smell, then the Army might then proceed to develop a stink bomb from it. Pam Dalton is a cognitive psychologist, and her interest in this is more to do with how we how our sense of smell works and what it is that makes us reel in horror when a revolting smell comes our way, which is something that people don't really know very much about. And the idea that this is going to be a terrifying weapon, it probably is going to be a terrifying weapon if they really do find the world's most repulsive smell. But on the other hand, it's better than bullets. And the main goal in developing this is to replace something like tear gas or pepper spray, which have known after effects. They can trigger attacks of asthma. They irritate your eyes and nose. If you've had a horrible smell that only worked psychologically, you don't have any of those effects. So if you had no sense of smell, you just wouldn't even know it was there. So that's the basic reasoning behind developing this thing.
How is the research done? I mean, how do you come up with these triggers for an emotional response?
Well, you have to encourage volunteers to put themselves in the position where they're going to sniff some of these revolting smells and then try and find a selection of really quite unbearable odors and monitor what happens when people sniff them. Now, some of this is physiological. You can check people's heart rate. You can see whether their stomach starts to move a little more, as if they're going to throw up. You can check their breathing. And some of it is psychological. How do they feel about it? What do they say afterwards? Do they start shouting and screaming as soon as they take a first whiff of this thing?
You write in your piece, could any stench really be so repulsive it strikes genuine fear into people's hearts and causes them to flee? Smells certainly have the power to alter our behavior. The aroma of fresh bread lures us towards the bakery, while the pungent of pong of a filthy toilet sends us reeling back to the door. Some smells are already used as deterrents. In the U.S., signs warn that some roadside furs are sprayed with a potent mix of molecules, including fox urine, to protect them from Christmas tree thieves. The smell is barely noticeable outdoors, but in the warmth of the home, the foxy stench is overpowering. And one company has even considered marketing a vomit-scented fridge freshener to deter dieters from snacking.
Yes, that's right. Well, there are smells that revolt us, but they're not going to be so powerful that they make us run away. The idea here is to find something that sets off the fear center in your brain before the conscious part of your brain works out what the smell is. And the sorts of smells that would do that would be things that you can't identify, you don't have any experience of. It's a sort of survival instinct. If you smell something and you really don't know what it is, it's easier to move away than to wait and find out if it's harmful.
Well, Stephanie Payne, I want to thank you for being with us. And as we learn about the stink bomb technology being developed at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia, which has an Army contract to develop this, we're going to look at other military academic collaboration. The National Research Council has just published a new study, Opportunities in Biotechnology for Future Army Applications, which examines the ways in which the Army could use biotechnology not for offensive weapons, the report claims, but for applications that will improve the effectiveness of U.S. soldiers in battle. 17 scientists from universities and private research centers participated in the 118-page report. We go now to Michael Ladish, who chaired the study. Michael Ladish, can you talk first, explain what the National Research Council is, and talk about the biotechnology applications that you've developed for use by the military?
The National Research Council is an organization based in Washington, D.C. It was established a while ago, many years ago, and it represents an organization that carries out studies for the federal government that are unbiased and that gather facts for the federal government and others on different areas, technology areas and other areas. As far as the research goes, our panel did not carry out research. Rather, what it did is it gathered information on existing fields and then met with experts in the field in order to determine what the future might bring with respect to biotechnology in the Army.
talk about some of the applications of biotechnology.
I think some of the applications of biotechnology that are going to come about in the future include medicines that perhaps will enable wounds to be treated more quickly, more thoroughly, foods that will help enhance soldier performance on the field, biosensors that indeed will detect toxins or other threats that a soldier might be exposed to, advances in vaccination that will help protect soldiers against certain types of biological threats, and also the application of proteins and biological structures for making advanced materials that could store information much like a computer disk does now, or materials that might, in fact, provide a special form of camouflage if incorporated into textiles.
Looking at the press release for your report on advances in biotechnology showing promise for improving Army readiness, it says that the technology is not for offensive weapons, but for applications that will improve the survivability and effectiveness of U.S. soldiers in battle. Is that true, not for offensive weapons?
This is correct.
Let's bring then John King into the conversation, who's a professor of biology at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. You've long been a critic of the uses of the academic-military relationship that has developed over the years here in the United States. Can you talk about your concerns about this study?
Well, first place, there certainly are some positive uses. I mean, wound healing would be an example where there are classes of, you know, military wounds like shrapnel wounds that you don't see in civilian life. This is natural for the Army to have a focus on it. On the other hand, there are other aspects which sound perfectly innocent, for example, vaccines. But if you examine the history of the debate over biological weapons, whether, for example, what we do is we strengthen the biological weapons treaty to prevent their development, which is actually the strongest treaty that exists in the international arena, or do we develop technical capacity? If you were planning, if the Chinese or the Russians tell you that they're just developing a vaccine, they're going to be, it's not so innocent, because you develop a vaccine because you're planning to use an agent against foreign troops or foreign civilian population, and then you need a vaccine to develop your own, to protect your own troops if they're going to go in. Let's say, into a third world situation. So what looks like a perfectly rational and humane development, improved vaccines, has a double edge. It looks to the other side like what you're going to do to prepare to use biological weapons. And, of course, if you're going to vaccinate, you have to have the infectious agent. You have to have the infectious agent that you believe the enemy is going to use. So you have to develop that capacity. And then you have the danger to your own civilian population that now you're handling very, very hazardous agents, agents that are designed to cause, you know, human damage, debilitation. And you're doing it under the secrecy constraints of the military, which is one of the problems that a local community can't weigh in and find out what's going on. One of the interesting things about the report, for example, conclusion in the results and conclusions, there's a conclusion 7 and 7B that talk about being exempt from certain kinds of regulation, oversight, national defense, quote, national defense needs might warrant special dispensation from these regulations, quote, approval of biotechnology applications that meet exceptional Army and other defense needs, meaning going ahead with programs that if you had civilian oversight or public health oversight, you'd say no. So the report cuts both ways, and a number of the proposals that seem, you know, straightforward and innocent, in fact, are areas of concern. I work on proteins. Proteins to make radiation-resistant devices is one of the recommendations. Why do you need radiation-resistant devices? Well, from a military standpoint, you're talking about operating after there's been a nuclear explosion. Well, in the arena of nuclear disarmament, that's considered destabilizing to try to survive, you know, nuclear war. What you're supposed to do is try to prevent the use of the weapons in the first place. So, though there are some good things in this report, there's a number of directions that I think, are not so innocent.
Professor Lattice, your response as chair of the report.
First of all, as far as the vaccination goes, I think we have an example toward the back, Professor King, that deals with, for example, malaria, and there's a lot of upside to sorts of advances that biotechnology could bring, not only to the Army, but also to the civilian populations as well. As you are aware, some of the troops will be sent to less developed parts of the world where certain types of diseases, such as malaria, might be endemic. And so as a consequence, right now there is no vaccine for malaria, but looking towards the future, this is possible positive benefit that would come from this type of research.
But I think
as far as your concerns regarding some of the conclusions you mentioned, these conclusions, in fact, allude to the development of new types of vaccines or medicines where if an emergency were to develop, not necessarily because of a developed nation having purposely developed some sort of agent, but just let's say something were to occur where, in fact, some sort of biological issue were to develop, then in that case, even if there were a cure which could effectively treat most of the troops, it could not be used under current regulatory guidelines. And so the issue is what should these guidelines be in an emergency situation?
But,
did not suggest that these should be, in fact, abandoned because our pharmaceutical industry and the health and well-being of the nation certainly benefit from many of these regulations as well.
But, the malaria example is a good example, and it's nicely described in the report. You have two options there, right? One is the question of Army in-house capacity, which is then operates under the national security regime of necessity by law. Or if you think that's a priority, and I agree with that a priority, then it seems to me the Congress should, give additional money to the NIH to develop in the civilian arena, if it's not a military technology, malarial vaccines.
Yeah, this indeed could occur, and I think at the beginning of the report, what the committee tried to do is identify areas where there was less than commercial incentive for industry to address some of these needs, whether it's for the Army or the civilian population. And so as a consequence, we felt the Army might, by applying some of its resources, be able to push some of these areas forward where there is a perceived need, but simply not enough commercial incentive at this point to get the job done. And certainly if NIH were to enter the picture, that would be another possible option, although our report was limited in scope and actually addressed what the Army is doing and could do.
One last quick question to Professor Lattice. In your report, conclusions and recommendations, you say the Army will have to establish new effective partnerships with the emerging biotechnology industry. What partnerships do you recommend?
The committee recommended a number of different possibilities. These included working with industry by funding certain types of research areas, both in industry and academia, that related to some of these applications. And thus, for example, in the area of using proteins that are, quote-unquote, radiation-resistant, I think, Professor King, what we were mentioning there were electromagnetic pulses. Those are sorts of pulses that are generated by a spark plug in a car, for example, but are very disruptive to computer memories.
Something like that would be
one way to go.
We have to end the discussion today, but we actually want to look at that issue of the electromagnetic pulses, especially when directed at crowds. And we are tomorrow going to continue to look at the military-academic relationship and bring in biotech industry as well. I want to thank Michael Lattice, who is chair of the new report that's come out for the National Research Council. He is a professor at Purdue University, and John King, professor of biology at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. That does it for the program Democracy Now!, produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson, Anthony Sloan, our engineer and music maestro, Errol Maitland, our technical director. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.